control. This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Woody Arnold. Woody is a comic writer. Woody, it's great having you on the show.
Thank you. Welcome. I feel welcome.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pillator.
Hi, Woody.
Hey.
I'm interested in cyberpunk stuff, so your art's pretty cool.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really interested in it, too. It's been a fun topic to write in the genre.
Woody, can you talk about how long have you been writing, and how did you get into, and how long have you been into comics?
Well, in reverse order, I pretty much was interested in comics from the beginning. I mean, like just like pretty much everybody else, you know, somehow we ended up with Archie comics in the house. You know, that seems to be something everybody reads. And I remember being at a 7-Eleven not far from my house and grabbing the first issue of the Transformers off the comic stand, and pretty much been hooked from that point on. But you know, as far as like writing goes, I mean, I've been writing for years. I couldn't even really tell you when I started. You know, I've written short stories and outlines for hundreds of things, and you know, scripts for comic books that could take me years to make. So it's just, I seem to never run out of ideas.
Are you you probably collect, you know, everything about graphic novels, right? Do you know of the works of Andrian Tomine?
I'm not familiar with that one. I don't know that I know everything, but I'm certainly informed. But,
yeah. I he's a New Yorker artist. I actually went to the like, comic book store to pick up his one book recently on that. But comic books, thinking of that, yeah, it's something of an interest of mine, too. It's, but I'm not into it. I'm not like an artist or writer. It is very interesting to talk about. I mean, I always liked Joan Vasquez's Johnny the Homicidal Maniac and Squee, but
yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because, like, you know, for as many styles of art as there are, there's just as many interests. And you know, you have your favorite creators. I have mine. And like Livio Raimondelli, he's I think probably the best Transformers artist ever. And every book that he does for IDW, I have to get it. It looks gritty and realistic, and it's, if you have a chance to look up his art, like the way he draws the Transformers, they feel real.
Some of the IDW comics are really cool. I used to like the Mars Attacks comics they were doing for IDW, and it come with the actual trading cards. I do like some of those trading cards they come with, and I think some of them, the one of their other properties, I can't recall, but recently. I used to do Bag and Board comics. This might sound really geeky, but I really like the SpongeBob comics by Bongo Comics. Have you read them? They're really cool.
You know, the thing about it is stuff like that's a little bit after my time, because you know I had friends who were, you know, they were adults and they were interested in Pokemon for some reason. But you know, it's like for me, the fandom, if you're going to go into that direction, it would have been stuff like Robotech and Space Battleship Yamato. And you know, show what we called it, Star Blazers in the United States. You know, I mean, I used to get up in the morning, and as a little kid, I hadn't figured out how to tell time yet, but I knew that when the 700 Club ended, Star Blazers would come on, and so I would turn on the show I wasn't interested in because I knew that the show I really wanted to see would be on next. You know, and that's my fandom right there.
Have you seen the new Captain Harlock movie? That one CGI film?
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned that because I was looking on Netflix right before – I'm actually traveling right now, and I was looking going through Netflix right before I left town, and it – I got about 15 minutes in, and I'm like, God damn, this is lame.
Oh, really?
I think I would rather see the original, you know, because it was just and not to criticize your interest in it, but it was just – I was watching it, and it was just – you know, it was hard to watch, to tell you the truth.
Mm.
Have most of your work with writing been comic related, or have you been writing a long time, and have you written any non-comic books as well?
Well, you know, I actually, you know, I like a lot of writers, I've done lots of short stories, and at one point I was thinking of writing novels, but I discovered that I didn't really have the temperament for it, for novel writing. It's like, you know, you writing all the descriptions of environments and, you know, describing things with words, not that I can't, but it was just like, it's very hard for me to keep my interest for the amount of time it takes to do that. And what I ended up discovering was that I went back and looked at some of my old short stories that I had written, and most of them were perfectly set up to become a graphic novel. So when I hit the point where I decided that was the direction I wanted to go, I actually started digging up some of my old stories, you know? So I would say I probably was writing comics for a long time. I just didn't realize it.
Were the themes of those short stories you wrote, were they kind of similar to comics, like action themed?
Yeah, you know, I actually come from a role-playing game background. You know, I haven't played as much Dungeons & Dragons, but I was really into science fiction games. I used to play, like, the old Robotech RPG and the Ninja Turtles role-playing game. And so my actual thought process with those kinds of things was I thought it would be a good testing ground to practice, right, you know, storytelling, because anyone can learn structure in terms of writing, but not everybody's going to be entertaining, you know. And the goal was to try to learn how to do something that that my friends would enjoy and keep coming back for. And I figured if I could do that, I was on the right track. But that tends to, as a result, you tend to be a bit more dynamic in your storytelling. And, you know, you want to try to create it tends to create a point where you want to build a balance between drama and action. So I do like to give my characters lots of interesting things to do.
Have you ever, what is your thoughts on Traveller and the cyberpunk RPG games?
You know, I never had to play Traveller. I actually got a copy of it one time, but I never got to play it. My aunt had found a box of old role-playing games in a closet when she cleaned out her apartment that had been there from before she moved in, and there was a copy of Traveller in there. But you know, I do like the cyberpunk genre a lot. I love science fiction. I think I probably would have really been into Traveller. You know, I cyberpunk seems to be a really interesting one. Probably I think the reason why it interests people so much is because our society is kind of going in that direction. You know, corporations are getting bigger and more conglomerated, and you know, they're gaining rights they shouldn't have. And a lot of what was predicted originally in the cyberpunk genre when it first was created is almost prophetic in terms of where we're going.
You grew up reading the original, like, cyberpunk novel, science fiction novels, like William Gibson and a lot of the films from the 80s that inspired cyberpunk.
Well, yeah, I think for me it was more the movies, you know. You know, looking at... you know, I really like Johnny Mnemonic. That film I really liked, and I've you know, Total Recall was amazing. You know, I love that film, and Blade Runner. In fact, Blade Runner was such a strong influence on my graphic novel that I actually, in the cover of our first issue, is a tribute to Blade Runner.
Yeah, that's I noticed also there's also that Shadowrun influence in there. Right.
Yeah. You know, Shadowrun, to a degree, you know, Shadowrun was one of many elements, actually. But the thing was that, like, a lot of my formative time period playing role playing games was with a lot of games that were, I used to play the Rift role playing game a lot, which pretty much had everything. But you know, prior to starting this process, I'd actually only played one session of Shadowrun, and my character died in 5 minutes.
Oh well.
So I didn't really have a lot of experience with it. But when you're going to get into But the thing is, when Shadowrun basically draws from all of the iconic elements of the cyberpunk genre, so it would be very hard not to blend elements. I mean, you know, I mean, I like fantasy races, and I like elves and dwarves and orcs. So if you're going to play in that region, I mean, it's, you know, Shadowrun did it too. You know, so,
they did it just with Tolkien and what happens if they're in a Neuromancer, and then you just get the product of. It's just so simple, that formula. I don't know. It kind of works well. It also reminds me of, like, cyber furries in some way. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that my artist, Eric, and I had both actually drawn from some of the similar manga influences. Like, both of us were big fans of Battle Angel.
Are you a fan of Akira?
Akira? A little bit. I actually like the soundtrack a lot more. It's one of those things where the movie was really groundbreaking, but it's like, I think I'd like to go back and read the comics, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things where visually I think Akira is more of an impact, you know. It's an interesting story because you have these government guys that are just absolutely reckless and stupid, and they, you know, pick a crazy drug addict kid and give him psychic powers, and, you know, that movie pretty much ends up the way it would in real life if that happened. So
you can also say that there's a pill reference in that too, because they're taking drugs and I don't know. And, referencing to Pill Eater, I was a fan of Akira as well. So,
Oh yeah. I mean, like it. You know, you look at that movie and what happened with that character, and it's just, you know, I don't see that scenario going well for anybody, honestly. You know, probably the character I think I empathize with the most is the Colonel. I think he was a Colonel because he's the only one in that whole movie that had a lick of sense. You know, so. But I mean, there are elements of it I really like, because, like, it starts with this really neat, really dramatic motorcycle chase. And, you know, one of the elements that I've looked at in comic books that I've read is that, particularly in superhero comics, they tend to, I kind of felt like the action scenes are kind of quickied, where you see, like, these big beats. You know, like, here's this shot, dramatic shot of Wolverine taking this person out, and then here's another shot of Cyclops, and here's another shot of this and that. And you don't always feel like you're involved in the story like you would if that action was taking place in a movie. Because, like, you know, the X-Men movies haven't really aged well, but you look at the fight scenes and they're pretty well choreographed, and you feel like you're kind of in there with the characters. And when I was putting together the action scenes in my books, I wanted to actually have it be more like you're in the event with the characters rather than seeing the key events, you know. So the story you know, is going to end, like, it's in the middle of it right now, you know, in online release, but there, the end of the chapter is a car chase, and it actually takes half of the chapter to resolve it. And you actually are seeing all these events as they unfold. And I wanted the reader to kind of feel like they were in there with the main characters as part of it.
Can you talk about the artist who does the illustrations for your comic series?
Absolutely. Yeah, his name is Eric Vargas. I actually met him at a Comic-Con last year when I was trying to find an artist. We'd had somebody tapped for the book who ended up not being able, is like a good friend of mine, who wasn't able to keep going because of a family thing that had come up. But, you know, we had so it's kind of a funny situation, because you had this art style you'd originally had in your mind when you created the series, and then you have to go ahead and, like, change it completely, you know. And I think I'm not going to say we made a step up, because I don't think that would be fair to either of them, but we definitely found, I think, the right guy to continue the series. And, you know, he has all the right stuff in his head to make it work. I mean, the visual language that he's created for the series is bringing it alive in some cases in ways that I had never even imagined. And he's bringing so much to the story. I'm really happy with it.
Was the strong a preference for the cyberpunk aesthetic? Was that more from you or him, or both equally?
Well, the story is actually, for me, I had actually written the story already. Like, I've been working on this series almost for 2 years now. You know, when I had first, you know, I had been started writing the story, and, you know, I knew I wanted to do something in the cyberpunk genre. And, you know, stick it in the future. And again, this kind of was where you blend into a Shadowrun, but, like, I live in Seattle. So unfortunately that, you know, makes a sort, again, a crossover with an existing property. But, you know, I like to write in the area in which I live, you know, because I'm so familiar with it. And I would presume a lot of my fans would come from my area. So it's relatable to them, you know. And but yeah, like, you know, I wanted something that you could go into my book and you could look at this street and you could find that same place in real life, you know. In fact, in our first issue, we actually destroy a bus stop that actually exists in Seattle.
Have you ever been anywhere where you really had that kind of cyberpunk feel to it, and you said, like, yeah, I really want to, like, capture this in my comics?
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of places in Seattle, I think, that are like that. I mean, the thing is if you go downtown in Seattle and you're standing there, it's interesting because Seattle is kind of – has a rural feel for the majority of it. Like in, you know, Seattle itself and King County and the surrounding places, there's so many trees and so much nature, and that it doesn't really feel like a big city sometimes. Right. But if you're in downtown Seattle and you're standing there on the streets and you're looking up at all the skyscrapers, cause that's basically what it is. I mean, you're, you know, in the shadow of the Columbia Tower, you know, you do start to feel like you might be in a cyberpunk universe. You know, there's actually an under, I don't know if you guys know this, but you know, we actually have a city under the city in Seattle. Like there really is an underground city in there that people don't know about.
Are you talking like an underground mall or more like an underground city for maintenance?
No, it's literally an underground city. What happened was that it's probably been about 100 years now, but the there was a point where they needed to do a massive renovation to the city after a fire, and the city planners came in and brought in debris and lifted the streets up by an entire level and actually raised the level of the city. And so there were a lot of buildings, particularly in the Pioneer Square neighborhood, where when you look, you're looking at what you think is the ground floor, you're actually looking at the second floor of the building. And there'll be the first floor is actually underground, and then there's a basement level below that and sometimes even deeper. And so there's actually this, like, for a good chunk of the city there, you know, there are these extensive tunnels underground from a city that has been forgotten.
I know, well, I haven't been there, but I know Montreal is famous for this massive underground city. Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't had the chance to go to Canada. Though I do know that they have something similar in France, I think underneath Paris.
In Toronto, I've been to Toronto. They have an underground mall. It's pretty cool.
Maybe I was thinking about Toronto.
Yeah, I've been there. The underground mall of Toronto. It's pretty fun on vacation.
Yeah.
LA used to have, in Century City, they had this, I talked about this in a previous show, they had this like kind of 70s futurist like underground mall, but mm-hmm. And it was used in some science fiction films, but they demolished it about a decade ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing about Seattle is, like, you know, we have some interesting issues with the city because there's currently a reconstruction going on the waterfront where they're having to rebuild it because of it was originally made instead of concrete. They made it out of wood pilings. So there's a mollusk, you know, in the water that's basically eating it. And then we also, you know, we're actually in an earthquake zone and we've had a bunch of minor quakes. But I'm kind of like conceiving in my mind that at some point, because it's 200 years in the future and kind of what in my story, so I'm kind of thinking, like, you know, there probably might have been another phase of the city being raised. So I've got like this more expansive underground city in my version, because like we have this bus tunnel, which is kind of silly because they should turn into a subway tunnel. But I'm kind of like imagining, you know, what if the bus tunnel got sealed and forgotten because the city built up again and it kind of it became obsolete, you know, and underground Seattle just expanded because, you know, they built it up again and had to raise it and, you know, to level out the hills. And, you know, I'm just, you know, in the writing process, you know, not just in terms of looking at Seattle as a cyberpunk space, but also looking at like, how would things evolve, you know, and how would the city look in 200 years as opposed to now? And most likely I think there would be just even more urban development, even more skyscrapers, and even more buildings, you know.
The whole sort of cyberpunk theme, it's often seen as dystopian. Do you see it as dystopian, and is your work dystopian?
Well, it is to a degree. You know, the world will get fleshed out more as we go along, but, you know, one of the themes of cyberpunk worlds is that you frequently have scenarios where – You know, you have, you know, the buildings get bigger and the wealthy people are living above the ground and the guys stuck on the, you know, stuck down below, you know, are generally people that are the don't haves. You know, you are going to have the middle class would be virtually gone. And that is the viewpoint I'm writing it from, that there is, you know, a massive separation between the classes. And you know, it's one of the hallmarks of cyberpunk. And, you know, with writing the book, I want to pay respect to the genre rather than try to reinvent it necessarily. It's like, you know, I want to put my own spin on it, but it should also be familiar to the people who are, you know, like they should go there and still find the things that they like, the things that are relatable about it, as well as the unique spin that you put on for your own story.
There's always this thing in cyberpunk, probably under Gibson's influence, that it's always that Japan or China rule the world. Is how much of that is a cliche in cyberpunk, or is it just necessary to have Japan or China rule the world?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, the thing about Japan, which you know, we kind of did it to ourselves with Japan, because with, you know, after bombing them to nothing and completely annihilating their culture to a degree, I mean, it's not that they don't have it, but it's just, you know, from the United States perspective, we completely destroyed these people and then we rebuilt them and you know, you got a culture that completely lost, and this more advanced culture comes in and says, okay, we are going to rebuild you, but we bring in our technology. Well, of course they're going to, you know, take on it with a zeal. And when you have a culture that had such tremendous discipline, cultural discipline, and, you know, they brought their aspects of it to this. I mean, it's no surprise to me that Japan advanced so fast technologically. It completely makes sense. As far as China goes, I mean, I know in the future of my world, I actually had a war between the United States and China ended up losing just simply because, you know, we had the A-bombs.
And which story is this?
For my cyberpunk universe. Mm-hmm. You know, because what I had done, and you can actually read some of it on the website, but I have had basically plotted out some of the major historical events through the 200-year span to kind of like flesh out how
200 from the present to 200 years from now.
Yeah, the story takes place in 2216. So, you know, like it essentially, there's a timeline of major events showing kind of like, you know, world wars and, you know, certain technological advances. I mean, it's something which is still evolving, but, and it evolves as the story progresses. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you know, this society has space travel. They have space stations. You know, human race has expanded and spread out. You know, they are, you know, colonizing Mars. And, you know, Cowboy Bebop was another element, you know, that I looked at. And there were elements of cyberpunk there that I really liked. It's a little too colorful, but I like the idea of the human race being able to graduate and go out. And, you know, the idea that Earth itself would become, you know, just this cesspool of laws and restrictions and slavery, or economic slavery, and that, you know, if you want freedom, you know, the new land of freedom might be a place like Mars, where, you know, people would go flock to that world because they can get away from, you know, the restrictions of the governments of Earth. It actually would not be that different from how it was when people left Europe and came to North America. And I think that kind of a trend would just simply repeat the historically would repeat that, you know, in the future. Same as it occurred to us.
On a previous show, we were talking to Dan DiArgenio, who is the two-time Netrunner world champion, and he was talking the same thing in Android Netrunner, in that fiction universe, that they go ahead and colonize on Mars. And contrasting the two, we were talking about cyberpunk, which is dystopian, and the other genre, vaporwave, which is more quite utopian, and saying how if everybody goes on Mars, then obviously they're looking for a new utopia away from dystopia. However, sure, at the same time, compared to cyberpunk and the other genre, vaporwave seems to be utopian in its light, because it's like loving 80s nostalgia, mall
but
life.
Got, both kind of based in the same 80s nostalgia, and they're both futuristic.
Well, I think it's tough to separate 80s nostalgia from the cyberpunk genre. You know, the 80s view of the future, you know, it not entirely accurate, but it sure was interesting. And too many of those elements, you know, I mean, like they're fun, you know. I think a utopian society, I mean, it's nice to think about, but I think it would be very boring. You know, you do need a certain balance. Well,
especially boring to write about.
Oh yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, I've read novels where they were going in that direction, and oh my god, they were boring. You know,
unless it's about the kind of implementation of a utopian society from a decaying society. But if you just describe like a perfect society,
yeah.
I mean, the aesthetics of it could be cool, but in writing, people like to hear about dystopian themes is a lot more interesting.
Well, I think it's very interesting, very telling. If you look at Star Trek, for example, which is a major cultural, you know, component for us, and people look at that society and go, "Yeah, this is what we want to achieve." But yet, the thing about it is yes, Earth is an ideal society, but we don't ever follow the drama on Earth because there isn't any. We go out into space where the adventure is, you know, and I think that's very, very telling, you know, because that's people, you know, the risk, the threat, the adventure, the unknown, you know, these elements are what's interesting and draw people in, you know.
In a cyberpunk society, it seems to be that, yes, 80s aesthetic is very important, but it also seems to blend in other things, like we were talking about Shadowrun and how that's Tolkien as well. It seems as over the years, as new trends come and go, like Vaporwave is very popular right now, especially in the music scene. That's going to add in more of a, I don't want to say anime influence, but probably this maybe 90s or even the past 2000 eras, maybe even the whole MySpace age, which is now obsolete, you know, compared to Facebook, that people now are loving these things, which are kished only 10, 20 years ago. And if cyberpunk is... Would cyberpunk be something only reserved for the 1980s, or is it going to evolve and take things and just make it better?
I think it's, you know, to tell you the truth, I think it's too popular to become obsolete. In fact, it seems to be, to me, it seems more popular than it ever was. Because, like, I mean, when I was writing the story, it was just simply, I had the story in my mind, and it fit a cyberpunk setting, right? It was the best way to tell the story that I was envisioning, but yet I carry this stack of business cards I print off on my printer at home, and I walk around and I kind of have this drill where I meet new people and I go, I just find an excuse to talk to them and hand them a card and try to, like, hey, I'm doing this project, right? And I would probably say about 75% of the time when I talk to somebody, their eyes light up when I tell them I'm doing a cyberpunk comic book. And, you know, a lot of them are excited that it takes place in Seattle, but it's just, you know, even amongst people that aren't normally in the comics, the fact that it's cyberpunk, they actually want to check it out, right? And it's roughly in the 75%, 80% category, right? And so of people I talk to. So I actually kind of think that cyberpunk might be on the rise, and I don't think it's going away anytime soon, because that's a high statistic of interest.
Especially with there's whole internet cultures now, and that people are becoming more attached to their computer, and things are getting much more done through such like Skype interviews or 4chan boards, or even fictional identities and subcultures that happen on the internet, which then influence our cultural in real life. The term IRL, you know, in real life, is kind of strange, as if the internet has more of a power for self. And I can see where cyberpunk, once predicted, is now becoming more of a reality.
Yeah, and that kind of worries me just a little, because I came from a time period when, you know, the internet didn't exist. You know, I grew up under the Cold War, where you didn't even know if you were going to be alive tomorrow, you know. And, you know, it's a different mindset. But like, we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have internet, none of this stuff existed. It was just science fiction. It was just this distant future that nobody could even imagine it would happen, and now we're living in it. But you know, it's like, I mean, we don't need all this stuff, right? I mean, there are certain advantages because it's like having this computer age for me made it so I didn't have to move to New York to get into the comic book industry, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it used to be you either had to go to New York or Los Angeles if you wanted to be in comics, but technology has brought certain advantages from, you know, for what I do. You know, we have access to things we didn't have before, but, you know, in some ways, some of what, you know, we do in the cyberpunk genre, you know, it's like, it's an interesting place to write a story. It interests people and it creates some very fun, dramatic opportunities for storytelling. But at the same time, you know, you're also kind of, by default, you're also warning people, you know, because, you know, you're writing about a future that none of us actually want to live in.
Yeah.
we like reading about it. It makes for a fun adventure, but nobody wants to.
Could you see, like, a cyberpunk theme being implemented in, say, like, a theme park or a Vegas casino?
I think that would be interesting. I think that, you know, well, the thing is that it's not that far away because we are advancing virtual reality to a point. Well, like I was just watching this guy I know, and he had a cell phone, one of those 360 video things. And he had the cell phone that was installed into a headset. He was wearing the headset, and the cell phone became a VR headset. And he's playing a horror video game and is freaking out like he's really experiencing it, right? Like we are almost at an age where cyberspace, which is one of the most critical elements that must be there for cyberpunk, where that's now becoming almost a reality with like a full sensation and interaction where you're hooked up and you no longer perceive your real world, but you're entirely perceiving interacting with this virtual world as if you're there. Like, that kind of technology is not that far away. And when we have that, the sky's the limit.
Yeah, I can see it happening very softly today, especially with making fictional identities on the internet. But I can see it slowly coming over. I mean, like, if you go on Omegle, you can literally chat to any stranger you want, a random stranger, and maybe be friends.
Well, I guarantee that somewhere right now, full immersion cyberspace exists. It's just not commercially viable, you know, because like HD television existed in Japan in the 70s. You know, like the QR codes that you can scan and open up a website or something, that technology has been around for decades. Again, like the technology exists. People have it, and it's just a question of getting it up to a point where it becomes commercially viable for the rest of us. You know, like in reality, most of the technology that we have in the United States is Japan's leftovers. Huh. You know,
isn't that kind of the theme of a lot of cyberpunk genre? Is sort of the leftover of a technology and of a great civilization. You see that theme in both Akira and Blade Runner. A society beforehand that was very advanced in technology, but it's in decay.
Well, the thing is like what you're seeing in Blade Runner is you're seeing cultural decay, but you're not seeing technological decay. And the society is still progressing in terms of like they're moving forward, but you have you have a point where like the culture itself is in decline, and you know you're seeing a society on the verge of imploding. You know, it hasn't died yet, but it is dying, and you know the. You know, there are indicators right now that our civilization is going through that the very same a decline, and those indicators have been there for a long time. You know, I guess like most writers who see these things, like you do hope that somebody wakes up. You know, like what you write might inspire them that hey, maybe we don't want to end up in that place. You know. You know, I think part of the reason why Blade Runner was shown to be the way it was, so dark, you know, everything was at night and everything looked old and worn out, like you said, is because it was prophetic. It was showing a possible future that could come to pass and maybe one that we want to avoid.
Who are the characters behind the I'm looking at it right now on Cyber yeah. Symbiosis. Who are the characters' backgrounds, their origins, and how are they conflicting with one another in the story?
Well, the answer to that question best actually goes back to how I wrote the story, because what happened was that I first had the story in my mind, and I had this friend at work who had found out that that I would run role-playing games, and pestered me for like a year to run something. And it was actually kind of funny because I had thought he was going to be a trouble, a real trouble player. And so I didn't want to do it. And then it turned out exactly the opposite, that he was absolutely amazing. He was not what I thought. And he was probably actually the least trouble of anybody I've ever had. So I kind of wish I'd taken him up on it sooner. But what I had done was to take a story and use my friends kind of as a testbed, and then write it based upon that adventure. What I had done was I basically had picked up a role playing game which looked like a fun system, whipped up some cyberpunk setting, and just basically had my friends create characters, and we just kind of ran through it. And I had originally intended to just run it for 4 sessions and call it good. And I was only going to just simply try out my ideas and get in and see what worked, see what didn't, and just kind of draw some inspiration. And we ended up going for about 6 months. We had all had a great time. And when it was all done, I kind of threw out my original plan of creating brand new characters and reinventing the story. And I kind of drew more inspiration from my buddies and used the characters that they had created. And which I normally wouldn't advocate doing, but you know, in this particular case, I think it was the right decision. And so what you're kind of seeing is a modified version of the people that were playing the game. One of the guys, my friend Eric, his favorite genre is blaxploitation, which is how we got the character of Conway. And, you know, he made this absolutely, well, I basically took what he had done and just turned up the insanity, you know, like, guy, you know, it isn't a perfect recreation of all these characters, but it is, you know, I think I took the best elements of them and what they were doing and created something that was very interesting, because, you know, it's the story has to work. And when you're running a role playing game with your friends, there is a lot of fucking around.
There's one. There's a one card game I like called Dixit, where basically you write, kind of make up a story with pictures as you go. The same way if you just play Arkham Horror. It's a big board game, but if you get through it, you know, you're playing a Lovecraft story. I mean, I really like the new Arkham Horror, the card game. That's really fun. Mm-hmm. It's a one-player game. You just do it with your cards and just... It's almost as if the game book format, or while playing a game, has the benefits of a story. And if you play a role-playing game with friends, and if you, like, put a recorder, a voice recorder on, you can, like, translate that into fiction. And I think that's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's, again, that's something I've been looking at for a long time, because, you know, you get some very unexpected things when you're tapping an improv troupe, which is essentially what role playing games are. And we ended up with some interesting character dynamics, looking at how they interacted. And again, the story is heavily rewritten. Like, it is not a word for word reproduction. Like, the first issue was about as close as it gets, and then after that it strays very heavily, and in some cases completely rewritten. But a lot of the major events are still there. A lot, you know, the characters are largely the same. I had to rewrite backstories and the characters needed to serve the narrative, and you know, the story is going to end up in a very different place than what it did when I ran it with my friends. It's like I actually am envisioning a 50-issue series ultimately. And, I'd like to hope that I can get enough support through Patreon to actually fund it and keep it going that far.
Cyber Symbiosis is the one. Is that the upcoming one?
It's the book I'm doing right now.
Your other work is Thunder Frog?
Yeah, well, I actually have 3 webcomics going right now, actually. Thunder Frog is a fantasy story, which is largely experiences reading the old Ninja Turtles comics, the black and white ones, from the 80s, before it became a cartoon. And the cartoons ruined it for the real fans. That was back when the turtles were still allowed to kill people.
I was thinking when I was looking at Thunder Frog, it's not like Usagi Yojimbo, right? Or is that, have you had any, what was the influence of that?
Well, Usagi, Not really that much. I didn't actually read much Usagi. I was mostly reading the original Ninja Turtles comics, though. You know, again, the artist there, that's what you're seeing is an example of good collaboration. You know, I was looking for something very specific in mind. Like I had, there was a quality I was looking for, and I ended up finding this really great artist named Tayson Martindale, who was essentially looking for his big breakout project, I guess, and we ended up again having a situation where we both saw the same thing and had come from a similar background of inspiration. And what I like particularly about what he does is he has this unique quality of being able to give the characters a degree of life, you know, because when you're looking at that comic book, it's almost like you're reading a story about people rather than comic book characters. And that book, by the way, is actually done. I have all six issues completed, but you know, I ended up deciding to release it as a web comic to try to, again, as part of my strategy of building my fan base through Patreon. So it gives me a little bit more content to release. And you know, if you want to read the whole thing, you can certainly go on our website and buy the whole series. But you know, there's probably enough content there to run it for almost 2 years as a web comic. So it's a, you know, it's working out pretty well in that regard too.
The only 50 comic, like I ever read through like 50 comic issues straight through, I think was one of the arcs for the Sonic the Hedgehog Archie comics. I think it might've been the second phase with, you ever remember the Sonic that, especially in the 90s, I was really young when I was reading those.
Well, I haven't read them myself because I wasn't a Sonic fan, but I have looked through them, and I will say, the guys that are doing the layout of the panel work for those are geniuses. Like that, the way in which, like when I picked up one of the digest issues one time in a Safeway, and I was thumbing through it, and man, the panel work in that was elevated and enlightened. I was really, really impressed.
I do like the Knuckles comics too. They're kind of outdated now, but I always have nostalgic memories of, like, I think it might have been 97 or 98, and I even had a Sega Genesis and playing Sonic and Knuckles, and at the 7-Eleven they would sell Knuckles comics, and I thought that was funny. And that's probably like one of the only 50 comic, the Archie Sonics, which is kind of almost embarrassing, yeah, because when people think of Sonic the Hedgehog comic world, especially the Saturday morning cartoon, it's like a mix between furries and cyberpunk.
Yeah, well, the game that I really liked was Sonic 2 because they had the really good race function where some of the levels were designed. So
yeah, I remember that. Each other.
And me and a cousin used to spend hours doing that, and that was great fun. That's actually something that I kind of missed when Sonic 3 came out, and why I never played it much, because they were trying to reinvent the wheel, and they didn't perpetuate the successful elements that made the game fun to play. And you know, I think that's probably where the downfall of some games are, is that the creators of the games either didn't have feedback or just didn't recognize the elements that people really wanted, and they were not maintained in you know, in future releases.
It seems like the character Riker in the comic Cyber Symbiosis, it's almost he's going on this first-person shooter persona that has the crossfires, and he changes into bike modes. is there a particular Gears of War influence in that?
Yeah. No, it's actually well, the thing about, okay, so like you were talking about character backstories, right? And Riker is actually He has the backstory that I can't talk about because it's kind of a secret. Okay. But which if the series continues long enough, you'll find out. The idea was actually more because what I can tell you about his character, a little detail that will come out in more as a plot point later, but he's basically blind and he can only see with those goggles on. And so looking at the character from that perspective, I actually thought it was kind of fun to think about how does he see the world, you know? And You know, his version of the world would have a HUD and would have lots of extra information, and he'd always have like this, you know, oh, the scanners will detect these people, and it's like zoom in on that guy and look at him, and oh, it gives you the data on, you know, how far away this person is, because he's the sniper, right? So it's always optimized that he's figuring out how far away the threat is, and you know, what are his chances of hitting the target and things like that. It's just it's just kind of like seeing the world through his eyes. In fact, if you look, there's actually a lot of that going on, because whenever the characters, instead of having like word balloon conversations and having like, you know, the usual kind of like exposition text that you would see in a comic book, you're actually seeing a little, what would actually essentially be a pop-up window, like light from Ghost in the Shell, right? Because in Ghost in the Shell, they had those video calls they were doing all the time.
Yeah.
The idea that I'm really shooting for with those exposition blocks is to kind of make it look like you're actually seeing the video call that the characters are having with each other. Mm. And you know, like Ghost in the Shell is probably one of the biggest inspirations for this series.
Are you excited for the Ghost in the Shell movie coming out soon?
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm a little apprehensive. I mean, it's actually funny to watch, because when you watch the initial trailer, what they're basically doing is a complete remake of the first Ghost in the Shell film, which didn't have a lot of substance, but it was visually stunning. It's clearly like virtually a shot-for-shot recreation of that film. But at the same time, they're also drawing a lot of elements from Standalone Complex, which was probably, I think, the best version of Ghost in the Shell. Outside of the original comic book. And so I'm intrigued to see what ultimately happens. Because like I know that the Laughing Man is going to be the main antagonist in the film. But it's really kind of early, you know. But I think that I am excited that Scarlett Johansson got to be in it, because I really want to see a Black Widow movie just like everybody else. And Disney's a little nervous about that. And I think that this may, yet again, putting her into a female lead like this, I think it may get us that movie. It may show, if this movie does well, I think it'll show Disney that she, you know, actually could headline a film. And you know, it's like I think in terms of just visually speaking, outside of an actual Japanese actress, I think it would have been, I can't imagine a better choice.
Mm. Yeah, I like the part in the movie just with the Depeche Mode cover, and that's all I can say.
that was definitely a good choice. Depeche Mode is probably the soundtrack to Cyberpunk.
What do you think about all that like new retrowave music? You familiar with that?
Most of my music interests are actually from the 80s, and when I'm into film, into music, a lot of the music I write or listen to is actually instrumental, like movie soundtracks, because it's tough for me to write dialogue when I'm listening to lyrics. Yeah, I'm not as up on modern music styles, I'm afraid.
What is some of your favorite music from the 80s?
Well, oh my goodness. See, that's the part where you're like, what are your favorite bands? And suddenly I draw a blank. You know, it's usually in individual songs, you know, that strike me. But I was a big fan of ABBA. When I was a little kid, ABBA was a literally top 40. And granted, it's not entirely the 80s, but I love that band. There isn't much from the 80s I don't like, though there are particular songs that I would love to not hear ever again.
Talk about your Thunder Frogs Studios.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, Thunder Frog Studios is actually... Okay, so I have my own label, which is Miniature Dragon. And then, so I would be kind of like the equivalent of, say, Top Cow Productions, right?
So and other people do projects for Thunder Frog Studios as well?
Yeah, so Thunder Frog Studios is kind of like an Image Comics label, where it's a series of creators, and all of those creators have their own things that they do, and then they all come together and do stuff under Thunder Frog. It's kind of like a comic book collective, so that we can pool resources and benefit each other. Thunder Frog's been around for like 15 years, based out of Seattle, but we have people all over the place. Las Vegas, you know, I've worked with people in Europe, so you know, it's like. It's kind of like a small version of Image Comics.
I was saying, it's interesting we're talking about role-playing games and how that influences the thought about storytelling. There's one book. Yeah. There's one book I really like. It's called Hamlet's Hit Points by Robin D. Laws. Hey, you know about D. Laws?
Well, I haven't heard of that book particularly, but go ahead.
Yeah, Hamlet's Hit Points by D. Laws is basically it's his theory where if you follow the system that he has, and you can apply it to, say, Shakespeare's Hamlet, some other stories he has, he gives you the full outline, and do it in a tool. I think it was a Casablanca, Dr. No, and he gives you the system where everything can be deconstructed into a role-playing game or turned a story into a game. And it's a very clever and witty book. And I read it. I read it like 3 years ago. It's in my library. I'm actually looking at it right now. And I just think it's funny because if you were to apply, like, say, Ghost in the Shell and read Hamlet's Hit Points and uses Robin D. Law's theory about his game design, you could pretty much take any story, turn it into a game, and then there's also vice versa, where you could take a game, like a role-playing story, and turn it into a story. And so there's a fine line between almost game design and story design, or writing a story.
Well, that's actually entirely what made TSR successful when they first created Dungeons & Dragons, and I think that it, deviating from it may be where the company failed. Because what they used to do is they would team up with people who had a fantasy series, and they would break down the, like, every chapter would be transformed into an adventure module that they could sell. And anybody could pick up one of these adventure modules and just mix and match as they liked and run it. You didn't even have to know what you were doing as a game master. Go ahead.
My favorite game books I really enjoyed were the Fighting Fantasy game books, where you would roll dice, you would have your health, luck, and stats. You would read a story, you would flip to turn pages, you would fight a troll, either you die, you kill the monster, you get something, and you're basically reading a novel while playing a single-player role-playing game. I tend to enjoy the Fighting Fantasy book series a lot.
I remember those. Well, you know, the subject of role-playing games versus writing is actually something that I could have a whole podcast about just that. Because, looking at the superhero genre, I do have some superhero stories. A lot of what I tend to come up with is more like The Watchmen, where it's deconstructionist. But the thing about superhero stories, as far as a genre, which I find kind of frustrating, is that you tend to get stories where the heroes are really larger than life, and they tend to just defeat everything, right? Like you know, I keep coming back to the standard example where you take Cyclops of the X-Men, and you know, how many times do you see him get hurt? It's really not that often. You know, it's like he usually sees situations that his optic blast can solve. And the only character that generally gets hurt is Wolverine, because that's what it takes to show what his powers are, because his main thing is his healing factor. And I look at superhero comic books, and I don't entirely see a realistic portrayal of people. You know, you see a portrayal of gods and demigods. But, you know, when you run a role-playing game, you've been a game master, your think is more along the line of, how do I hurt these people just enough to make them feel threatened, to make them feel challenged and feel in danger? You know, how do I create enough threat where they have a risk of getting killed, right?
Whereas, in Cybersymbiosis, would you say that's the case with your main character?
With all of them. Well, it's there's no really one main character in Cybersymbiosis. It's more of an ensemble, but yes. I mean, like, these guys are in real danger in this story. Like they are in you know, they're going through a series of events where the threat for them is real, right? And they
is there a clear villain in the story?
You know, it's funny you say that, because there is a villain, but you know, the actual real villain is the character that won't get met for a while. But they do have a number of antagonists. I'm a big fan of the moral gray area. And so the people who are the antagonists in this story as it goes along are not necessarily going to be evil, because in real life, true evil is only a small percentage of the population. And when we're at war, you know, we're fighting against people in Iraq or wherever the war is. And those people aren't they may be the enemy, but they're not villains. You know, the villain was Saddam Hussein, but, you know, like his soldiers didn't want to fight for him. They were surrendering. He wouldn't even feed them, right? Like, you know, on any other day, you'd be going to a bar and having drinks with these guys and looking at pictures of their kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not accurate towards reality, but I also think it's like kind of like so cliche. Obviously, it starts with like the Disney films of like the hero and the villain. But yeah, you see that even in a lot of films that cater to adults. There's the villain who's pure evil, and the main character who's pure good, and that just gets really boring.
Yeah, and I think that a story is going to be way more relatable if the characters are relatable. Like the villain of the story, the guy who is ultimately going to be the villain of the story, right, in the first major arc, you know, he's actually got a legitimate grievance against the main characters, right? Like you are going to be...
Can you say what that grievance is, or you don't want to give away too much?
Well, I don't want to take away too much because I actually subscribe to the what I like to call the Chris Claremont School of Writing, where I'm taking my time building the story. But once the foundation is there, you know, then you've got something that will carry the story for a long time. You know, like one of the things I loved about the original X-Men run is that he would spend 2 years setting up an event, right? Like, you know, you'd go back and read old issues and you'd discover that he was laying the foundation for stuff that he was planning to do in 5 years, right? And so looking at that aspect of it, you know, I think I'm doing a disservice to the intelligence of the reader if I lay all my cards on the table in the first issue.
Have you ever read X-Men 92? That recently came out.
I haven't, actually. I was looking at it. You know, it's the thing was that I actually was really frustrated with that cartoon because I was I was reading the X-Men when that came out. And, you know, the thing that bothered me the most, and of course it makes sense because it's a kid's cartoon, but it's like, how many episodes did they have Wolverine standing there with his claws out and couldn't use them? Like, it's like, there was an episode where they were being attacked by Romanian people or whatever, like, you know, some group of people with pitchforks and torches, and Wolverine had his claws out, and his bones are covered in metal. He could just wade in and punch those people. He didn't need... He's, like, complaining about how hard it is trying not to hurt them. He didn't even have to have the claws out. It's not like they were a threat.
Like, there's no violence. You know? That's the ideal, right?
Yeah. Like yeah, those people were... Like, he was in no danger. They were in... He didn't even need his claws to be a threat. It you know, and... I mean, there were a lot of good things about that cartoon, and it was great. But and I watched every episode, but there were also some stuff where I just rolled my eyes at, you know, so...
On your Facebook page, it looks like you also collect the HeroClix models. Is that right?
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. You're looking at my addiction. I don't play HeroClix much, but what I actually do is I collect them and I chop them and make things out of them. For our role playing games with my buddies, what I do is I actually have this massive collection, tens of thousands of miniatures that I've got shoved in places around my room. And then I find pieces and I cut them up and build new characters pieces out of them. So I actually make all the miniatures for our campaigns.
Yeah, I remember I love this one board game called Wiz War, and I have the old fifth edition, and we'll use Mage Knight figures and play a huge 8-player game of Wiz War and just go out, duke it out from there. But yeah, I could see Mage Knight HeroClix figures are definitely the interesting. Oh, once yeah. You get Street Fighter HeroClix and then that universe, yeah. And it's goofy.
Yeah, yeah. Mage Knight was amazing. Like some of the early pieces are not very good quality, but as it went on, they really got amazing. Like anytime I stumble upon some Mage Knight pieces, I snatch those things up. You know, right now we're running. Well, it's on a break right now because I'm traveling, but we were doing a Star Wars RPG, and I made everybody's characters, and like a buddy of mine actually sculpted a hut for us out of Sculpey because one of the guys wanted to play a hut. But I, you know, I've got a Twi'lek character I made, and I've made a bounty hunter character for a guy who's actually inspired by Cad Bane from the Clone Wars, and I made a battle droid character for another guy. So I've got like, all the characters people are playing are I usually make custom miniatures for every character.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm at least 300 deep at this point in custom pieces.
Compared to Warhammer, you got to assemble it, paint it, and then assume that everyone, you're also in the whole Games Workshop universe. I kind of find it's more easier to just buy painted in China figurines and then just play a game from there compared to the whole art and craft of modeling, which is a different hobby on its own, but it's weird you can... Well, like, there's right now, there's the new edition of Space Hulk. They announced a new edition of Blood Bowl. And it's cool that you can get their games, yet they're more focused on the whole painting aspect, right? And so I find it interesting that Games Workshop, it's still a painting hobbyist company at its core. But they give you that game with rich history. if you want to play and reward yourself. But at the same time, there's also a whole market of people that just want to play the game.
Yeah, well, you know, like Games Workshop, they have great paints, good brushes, and they have really good weapons. I love the weapons, but, you know, a lot of the pieces that they make are actually kind of out of scale for what I do, and God, they're expensive, but, like, you know, because I'm using Mage Knight and Heroclix as the base starting point, so it kind of means that you're dealing in a certain scale. I think it's called the heroic scale, but it's just, you know, like, most Space Marines are not very useful, you know, for what I do, because they're so massive and so big. And, you know, unless I was trying to build a power armor suit, I don't know that those are very, very effective. You know, because, but you also need a wide variety of stuff, because, you know, we're doing Star Wars now, the next one's probably gonna be a fantasy game. So I need to dip into an entirely different category of pieces to make to make the fantasy characters for the next one. And then, you know, the next one we might be playing a science fiction game, and that's a completely different thing than doing superheroes, you know? And so it's like, I have...
Is that action figure you have on your avatar, is that from Cyber Symbiosis?
Oh, you're talking about my avatar here for Skype?
Yeah.
That's actually just... That's funny you say that. That's actually made from a combination of MechWarrior and Mage Knight pieces. All it was, I just had... See, what happens is I'll sit at home, I'll be on a phone call, and my desk is covered in pieces of miniatures, and I just start... If a phone call goes on too long, I start getting idle. So I'll just start grabbing whatever's nearby and chopping it up and start making things. And that just simply was the result of one of those afternoons.
We are getting at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Woody, do you want to tell our audience more about your upcoming project, Cyber Symbiosis? And do you want to plug your Patreon page?
Yes, thank you. Yes, definitely. Okay, well, right now the comic book's available. I think we're up to page 12 right now. It comes out every Tuesday, and you can read the comic at the website conwaytheseries.com, and it's just it's the ongoing adventure in our cyberpunk version of Seattle. And I also am releasing two other comic book series that you can also check out on the website. One of them is of course the Thunder Frog, which we mentioned, and another one is called Gamers Alterations, which is based upon the Gamers and Journey Quest film series, and with a little bit of introduction from Voyage Trekkers. And I'm funding all these projects through Patreon, and it's patreon.com/WoodyMakesComics, and you know, I've got some, you know, really good rewards and incentives for people. I'm actually adding on a new one soon. You know, really, I just need to fund this project. You know, we need to get up to a point where we're making at least $400 a month. If we can hit that point, then Cyber Symbiosis will be able to run forever. I'm confident I can keep it going. I just need to take the sting out of it. But I am trying to fund a few other books as well through this thing. And I would hope that what I'm doing is something fun and cool, and people want to support it.
Woody Arnold, it's been an excellent show. Thank you for being on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And also, thanks, Pillator.
You have a really cool comic, Woody. I'll definitely be checking it out every Tuesday.